And that's where eco-villages will really sort of rise from. It's the best description of permaculture is organized chaos.
Hello, and welcome to the Permaculture Vine podcast, where we talk about permaculture, education, careers, and business. I'm your host, Cormac Harkin, and today we have Doug Crouch. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you.
Could you just give us a quick 30-second introduction, please?
Yeah, I'm Doug Crouch. I run a organization called Trio Permaculture. I started in permaculture about 20 years ago and have practiced permaculture globally, and am both an educator, a designer, installer, and a producer on my 60-acre homestead.
Sounds great. A lot to cover there. You want to just take us back to the very beginning of when you heard about permaculture?
Yeah, sorry. My cat is, of course, wanting to sit on the computer, as cats love to do. Ow, kitty. So I grew up in the suburbs of a, you know, Midwest industrialized town in the United States. And so I knew nothing about farming, healthy eating, and all of that. But my family has always owned this 60 acres since 1983. And it was my grandparents' place. And there was a new breath of life being put into the place because we decided to rebuild the dam. So there's a 12-acre dam, 6-hectare dam on the lake and or on the property. And so a buddy of mine was like, hey, if you want to run this place one day, you should study fish and wildlife management. And so I moved across the state, started studying the environment that I knew nothing about. And I just immediately fell in love with biodiversity. And as the years progressed, it was a 2-year degree, but I had to take my time to work and, you know, pay for it at the same time. I started to understand that the biggest detriment to fish and wildlife habitat was agriculture and forestry. And so I ended up going to the West Coast to study more, but became completely jaded by university and the mentality of the reductionist way, and just seeing the corporate greed all over the country. And that's where I found out about permaculture on the campus of University of Oregon, where they were having a conference, and found Lost Valley Education Center, which has been a very important education center in the West Coast movement for producing a lot of really good permaculturists. So that was in 2005. I took an 8-week eco-village and permaculture training. And then from there, went to Costa Rica in 2005 to farm on a permaculture location, biodynamic farm as well, and an education center. And that's immediately when I started teaching, because I had a background in aquaculture. So I got the job because of the background in aquaculture, and then was able to teach in these programs that they were running in the aquaculture as well.
Great stuff. So the 8-week eco village, do you want to tell us about that? The PDC, was that a PDC?
It was PDC and eco village training. So it was an absolute fantastic experience. I was a university student. This is kind of a funny story. I was a university student and thought, wow, this would be great. I would love to do this. And when I moved to the West Coast, the day after I moved to the West Coast, my family's new McMansion suburb house had just flooded with sewage water because of a failed pump. And all this stuff, all this, you know, consumerism stuff that I no longer wanted, because I was rejecting that lifestyle, was in their basement and was flooded. And I got an insurance check for $2,100. And I paid $2,100 for my permaculture course. So yeah, it was residential. We were camping in a meadow. We were going to class every day. I was hiking and obsessed with picking berries. There was so much berry fruit around, and, you know, giving it to my classmates. I didn't know anything about that particular ecosystem, but because I'd been trained in fish and wildlife management, I was able to pick up the guidebooks, learn the ecosystem around, started teaching other people in my class about the native plants. And, you know, at that time, I had never planted one single vegetable in my life. I knew a lot about taking care of habitat and taking care of forests, how to augment water ecosystems, but not anything about agriculture per se. So that was a big eye opener. And for me, it was fantastic because when I was at university, even though I was in this really hippie place, I was the radical one. I was the one that was saying, why does corporate greed get to diminish fish and wildlife habitat? And then all of a sudden, I found myself immersed with other people who were really passionate about making the world a better place, not just fighting against it. So for me, that was the biggest thing, was because I was being recruited by some of these groups like Earth First and people who were chaining themselves to the redwoods. And I completely agree with, you know, all of their approach, but it didn't resonate with me. What I wanted was a positive response, like, because I have so much energy to put forth. I just wanted something that I could put like the positivity, because that helps with my mental health. So finally, I found that during that PDC, and I had fantastic teachers from all across the world. And because it was extended, I got that experience of communal living as well, because community is such a part of permaculture, and got more depth on so many different topics.
Great. So you went to Costa Rica after that. How come you didn't go back to the family farm then? You went to Costa Rica instead?
That's complicated. I had a falling out with my grandparents after I finished my fish and wildlife degree, because I wanted to do some things differently. And they were very old school, and they were actually city folk who had moved to the countryside. They didn't know much about ecology. They were in their 70s. They were set in their ways. So this building that I'm in used to be a bar, a pub, and they had a fishing lake. And so that was the business. And I was trying to like to make it more eco-friendly, and it just didn't work. And so I was also very jaded by the current political atmosphere in the States. So I know there's a lot of people getting into homesteading currently because, you know, the COVID down, you know, that whole, whatever you want to even call it, I mean, the COVID, the 2020 election, inflation. And for me, like, people's 2020, hey, I'm going to get into this. Mine was 9/11. I moved to Southeast Ohio to study fish and wildlife management on 9/11. It happened to be the day. Then the Iraq war and the 04 election, which was, it was obvious, it was pretty corrupt, the election of Bush and Gore. So that was my moment of, hey, I want a homestead. And I didn't want to be in the United States. I just felt like it didn't resonate with me, especially since what I wanted to do with the land was not in conjunction with what my grandparents in their quasi-retired state were looking to do.
Yeah, a bar and a lake does sound fun. So Costa Rica, so you went there and you found an eco village there?
Yeah, it was a small eco village, and it was an international crowd, and it was a very mixed farm. It's actually pretty similar to what I have here in some way, in Kentucky. But I don't have the commune part. So there was many of us living on the land, and then there was a transient woofer, you know, train of people always coming through, and they actually paid to stay at the hostel and then work a few hours. It was great to learn from Rick, who was a biodynamic farmer. It was really great to learn from the Ticos, the Campesinos. I learned so much from them, including some Spanish, but just the culture of living in the countryside in a tropical location. And, you know, it was the classic patron system. And there was some issues communally because of that. You know, you have the wealthy landowner, and then you have all these like people working underneath to achieve the wealthy landowner's sort of goals and visions. And like everybody, it just, you eventually find the end of the road with that. It serves you for a certain amount of time. And then, you know, you're like, hey, this is, I want to go on and do something else. So that led me to New Zealand through some of the classes that we were teaching on the farm. I met somebody who was working in a study abroad high school in New Zealand. And so I left for New Zealand because my best friend during the permaculture course was also in New Zealand. And she was studying underneath Robina McCurdy, who was one of the teachers in the 8-week PDC in Oregon. And so I was like, hey, this would be fantastic to go and get paid because they had the working holiday visa. So I could legally immigrate, for a year. And then eventually I immigrated fully because that, school closed and a wolf farm offered me, a position, and I was able to obtain a proper work visa. So I had my papers to stay, and that farm where I farmed for about 9 months as well was edible tree crop farm. I think it's number 99 in the designer's manual. If you open up the designer's manual, you know, you have the pictures on the inside. So number 99 was edible tree crop farm. And that was Dick Roberts who planted that. And Dick Roberts supposedly started the wolf program, especially in New Zealand. He was a British photographer for National Geographic, and he explored the world, and he was constantly bringing plant material back to the South Island of New Zealand. And this was a time where, you know, nobody cared about the native vegetation or whatever, and he started planting all these tree crops on this 300 acres and doing silvopasture with sheep. And he would put these, you know, metal barrels, these 55 gallon metal barrels, I don't know, they probably had petroleum product or something in them before, and then cut the bottom and the top off and then put that around the tree when they planted them to keep the sheep off the bark. So yeah, I learned so much at that site by seeing a mature food forest, a mature silvopasture system. It was just a fantastic area to live in, Nelson, New Zealand, in this particular valley called Todd's Valley. Is a Mediterranean climate, but quasi subtropical, and just chock full of people with amazing gardens and farms.
Right. So even at this early, well, I don't know how long I'm on, but you're getting a lot of different climates there, some education and experience.
Oh, for sure. So that, you know, in the totality of my 13 years of permaculture travel. So the story gets much longer. So just so you know, timing wise, I tried to make an effort to go to as many different climates and contexts as possible. But also I was open, you know, I'd get an email one day, can you do this project later on? Once I started teaching and doing more of the permaculture installations, can you come to X country and teach or help me develop this piece of land? And I liked when it was different climates and different contexts and different, the culture, of course, meets those two together. That is what a traditional culture is. And then bringing forth a permaculture. Yeah, it was a nice fusion.
So what happened then? You left New Zealand to take it?
Yeah, I just found New Zealand to be too far away. Hadn't seen my family in a while. And just, you know, It did the same thing. It ran its course. And so I ended up going back to the West Coast of the States, and doing some internships to learn more about the nursery business and CSA growing. And unfortunately, that experience was cut a bit short by fires in California. And so had to leave the farm because of just, there was no customers to sell because it was months and months of fire. And it was really tough on the body. And, but I was also starting to reconnect with Lost Valley Education Center and start to teach more. So also in New Zealand, I was teaching, working a lot with Rabina McCurdy. And she was my mentor, and her partner Huckleberry, and just, yeah, really seeing how I had a passion for educating. My aunt was a fantastic educator, won Educator of the Year in Ohio. And she always told me, like, you will be a teacher. That, you know, she said to my brother, you'll be a lawyer. And me, I'll be a teacher. And so, so I started to reconnect back to Lost Valley. And after, you know, a couple different stints in California, I went back there and was contributing to their education programs and stepping much more into doing more sessions on tropics, some chiming in with much more practical experience because I'm several years into the permaculture career. And then that led me to take my teacher's training in 2008 in Big Sur. At Esalen. So my style in the States, you really have this sort of like East Coast, West Coast thing. It's not just a rapper thing. Right. It also is influenced. The permaculture movement is influenced in that way. So the East Coast is more like Dave Jackie and this really in-depth design process. And the West Coast, I would say, is a bit more creative, a bit more pattern based, you know, left side brain, right side of the brain, it seems like. So when I was at the teacher's training, a friend of mine that I made at the course was like, hey, I'm going to teach a free course in Oroville in India. You should come. And I was like, I should come. I have absolutely nothing to do. I have no home. And I had no money, but I did crowdfunding before there was, you know, crowdfunding. I asked people around me in these eco villages that I was passing through, wrote family members, made posts in permaculture forums, started getting checks just randomly in the mail to be able to go and teach permaculture in South India. And that's where I stepped from just being a support or a gopher on the courses to actually being a lead teacher in early 2009 in Oroville.
Yeah, so 8 years in your career before you started actually teaching as a lead.
So that's no. Well, yeah, I suppose 8 years because I was studying ecology. Essentially, it was a 2-year practical permaculture degree before I ever took my permaculture. But I took my permaculture, my PDC in 2005, and by 2009 I was lead teaching.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a bit early, but you know,
well, I think it was experience to back it up. I thought 4 years was plenty because a lot of people will get a PDC and they want to start teaching straight away.
Yeah. And you need experience, and it helps if you have a few different climates and contexts, not just your backyard, whatever.
And it's a good example of where you just went everywhere. I'm not sure that's not everybody's going to be able to do that, but I think it's a good example to get out and explore everywhere. So where are we now? We're 2009. You started teaching in India. What was that experience like?
That was wild because I was at a eco village within Oroville called Sadana Forest, which was a reforestation project run by an Israeli couple. And we When I first arrived, there was like 70 of us at the property. And by the end, there was 130. He just kept saying yes to all these people traveling through. And it was so many people, so much energy. And I had a couple of weeks with my friend that I was teaching with to prepare. And we're sitting down in one of the thatch roof huts preparing for the PDC. And this tall, impressive Frenchman walks in and he chuckles first. And he says, I hear you two have the funny idea of teaching a PDC here. And we look at each other like, yeah, we do. And he just sits down. And then that was Trio. That was the three of us that formed Trio Permaculture. So we were studying, we were finding places to go for hands-on experiences, field trips. We were putting together a really dynamic 4 or 5 week program. I think it was a 5 week program. And so the program was you teach in the morning. We do hands-on in the morning because it's India. It's bloody hot, right? So, and then you teach during the afternoon, which is always a challenge to keep people awake in searing heat after a vegan meal. So, and midway through the course, a virus that even hit the Indians, which was about the same time that the original, I think, SARS swept through the world, especially that part of the world. 90% of us at the Eco Village got this virus where we all had extremely high fever and extreme diarrhea for weeks. And some people were hospitalized due to dehydration, especially the people that got it early. And we as a collective started to figure out how to take care of each other. So I think that's one of the things when you travel to the tropical countries that you're not accustomed to living in as a northerner. You know, I come from a very temperate climate, four seasons. It tends to, you know, the food sickness or these different bugs, and they really get you. And there's not much reprieve because of the heat and just, you know, rustic conditions. So that was very challenging. And I think it just shows the resilience of community, of what is possible in an eco village. So overall, it was a great experience. And while that was happening, when I was at Lost Valley in 2008 during this 4 week program, one of the students was a UN funded student from Malaysia. And she had said to me, hey, I really like your teaching style. If you ever find yourself as a lead teacher and in this part of the world, come teach a PDC at my place. And I thought, well, I'm never going to be on that side of the world. And then 2 months later, I look at a map once I land in India, because it was such a whirlwind to get to India. And I saw that Malaysia was kind of just right around the corner. So while we're teaching, we're also forming the brand and lining up the next course in Malaysia. So India led to Malaysia, and also doing work and teaching on one of four farms in Singapore.
Great stuff. So you said you formed Trio then. There's three of these in Trio. Yep. Permaculture. Yep. So we've had our own challenges with partners and working with various people here. How did you get that sort of synergy between the three and keep that momentum going?
Well, it didn't keep going. I think having an umbrella, like your brand, my brand, to allow people to come and go, is going to be normal until like a larger company is formed, the economic pressure, the pressure of place, is going to essentially create the flexibility for breath in, breath out. People are going to come in and they're going to be within the umbrella of the brand, and then the breath out. So once we were finished teaching in Malaysia, that constellation never was there again. Me and Gauthier, the Frenchman, we worked for several years in Europe. The Europe chapter is coming after India, Malaysia, Singapore. But I have never seen Kyla again since. And we, you know, we messaged a few times, and it was at that time, it was just a brand. There was no legal name. It was just a website on WordPress that my Malaysian friend was like, oh yeah, it's really easy to build websites now in 2009 with WordPress. And I still have the same website going since then. So I do think building the momentum of a brand is quite difficult. And there's been people within the permaculture movement who have grown a bigger sort of organization, like Jeff Lawton, or even Food Forest Abundance currently. But on a like on a small scale, I think it's difficult to keep that synergy going.
Yeah, that's what we find. And the way we work now is Mike and Crystal will come in and they help with the course, the PDCD Pro. But then they've been away. So they that breathe in, breathe out has happened to us. So basically now we share, we have the blog. So we put articles on the Vine blog page so we can all reference that. So we have three independent practices ourselves locally. And then sort of we can all reference the blog when we're talking to clients. And it's like, oh, you want to know about composting? Here's the article. So yep. We sort of pulled that knowledge, our body of work together under the Vine brand. It's interesting you say that you think that's the way it's going to go in the future.
Yeah. I think in the Western world, as the economics continue to, you know, push towards hyperinflation or towards really high cost of farmland, just this high cost of living that is happening from mainly corporate greed. The kings and queens have us in serfdom. I think more and more collective power is going to become necessary. And that's where eco-villages will really sort of rise from in the Western world, because communal living is going to be how people afford and how basically subsistence agriculture takes place, right? Like this movement of homesteading, let's be honest, like it is a form of subsistence agriculture. Like, hey, I want to get chickens. You know, I'm staring at my flock of sheep that started at 4 and I'm looking at 2 babies that were born 3 hours ago, you know? So, and my flock within the next week will be up to 50. And that is just to secure my own food supply and support my bioregion with quality genetics of animals that are taken care of organically, and with rotational grazing, you know, herbal medicine and stuff like that, rather than the conventional food system that is failing us on so many layers. So I do think more community, communal living, eco-villages, intentional communities, whatever words you want to use, are going to increase in the next 5 to 10 years, which is what Rob Hopkins said, right? Like he came up with the number 2030 of like, we need to transition to this low carbon society by 2030. And I mean, if from a futurism perspective, I think Rob Hopkins has been the most accurate with predictions of social unrest, of prices, of the conglomeration of power. So for me, I mean, I understand what is taking place, and I'm just doing what I love anyways, farming, providing food to my friends and family and my community, in the highest quality as possible.
Yeah, I think that's all we can do. I don't really trust the people that cause the problems to fix the problems. So we have to get together and sort them out ourselves. So you went to Singapore then? And
yeah,
then Europe?
So, yeah, so Singapore, we kind of toggled back and forth between Malaysia and Singapore after we did a 2-week PDC in Malaysia. That was a fantastic experience, being in just such a foreign environment. Like in India, it was a Western enclave, Auroville. But Malaysia, there was 4 or 5 of us of European descent. The two teachers, there's three teachers, sorry, and then two participants, and the rest were Asians. And Malaysia is such a melting pot, right? So you have the Chinese Buddhist, you have the Indian Hindis, you have the Malaysian Muslims, and then some of those groups who have gone on to become Christians. And so that melting pot was incredible to experience. Some of the best food I've ever eaten was right there in Malaysia, because the chef was an Indian woman, and organic produce from a local farm that she lived on. And then Singapore was just such a wild experience of seeing the contrast of commercialism. Wow, what a country just so dedicated to commerce. But we were able to reach a lot of people who were interested. And then, yeah, landed in Portugal to take one of Sepp Hulser's classes. I don't even remember what it was called, at Tamara, the eco village in southern Portugal. And at that conference, that's where I met a family, a Portuguese family. And I worked with them afterwards from 2009 to 2017.
Wow, a big stint in Portugal.
Yeah, I mean, it was off and on, but Pedro and Rita became business partners. They had a Waldorf school already, and so we already had a location. Pedro was a famous rock star in Portugal. Is a famous rock star in Portugal with a band called Blasted Mechanism. And so he was on TV a lot, also saying permaculture, permaculture. And when I showed up in Portugal in 2009, that country was empty. You know, Portuguese people have fled Portugal for a very long time to seek more economic prosperity after the dictatorship fell and after the EU kind of ruined their textile industry, which was the backbone of their country. And so it was really just a incredible journey to see the country fill back up with people from all across Europe, all across the world, to take this abandoned country and bring it back to life. And it was special to be a part of that permaculture education and the forming of a more regenerative culture in that country for so long.
Yeah, there's a land's very cheap there in comparison. And I've noticed a lot of YouTube channels about moving to Portugal, setting up homesteads, rebuilding ghost villages. So it's, for me, it would be a great option here in Ireland. I've got my EU passport, but too far away for the family.
Yeah.
But I'd love to go. So then you went back to the States then, 2017, was it?
Yeah. So I had the chance to teach and work in Portugal and Spain and Italy and Slovakia, Bulgaria. And during that time, I did 6 months in Argentina, 3 months in Dominican Republic. And then I'm always coming back to this piece of land. Treasure Lake is the name of the piece of land. And And then 2017, I'm exhausted, because by then I'm, if I'm in a place for 2 weeks at a time, that was a long stint, because I'm just all over the place doing installs, teaching classes, PDC here, flying there. And I had my papers in Portugal in 2013. I started that process, and I was just tired. I was tired of new. Everything was new all the time. New, new, new. And I was seeing that I was getting towards a plateau in my own learning about permaculture because of the lack of longevity, the lack of day in, day out grind that I'm doing here to build a farm. So, sorry, there's a couple of red finches right here. So I was sitting just right over there and caught wind of the fires in Portugal. And I had a friend whose parents lived in that village, and the agonizing wait to understand if my friend's parents had died in that awful fire. I just was like, man, I have given so much to this peninsula, the Iberian Peninsula. I think I'm ready to retire from the global permaculture scene and spend time on my family land and develop it finally like I had been talking about and dreaming about for years. And it was an addiction, like, to be honest, like being in front of the crowd, being on the airplane, being new, work hard, party hard. It took some years to like decompress and really get going here. And it coincided perfectly with COVID, because imagine if my business model still was global permaculture travel. That would have been just an absolute nightmare for those 2.5 years. So luckily I was here and had put down roots and really started to ramp up the production side during COVID.
So take it then, when you're on the road, you're traveling, you're noticing things, picking things up and saying, oh, that would do great back in. Are you thinking the gap? Are you planning the whole time you're away?
Oh, yeah. I'm when I would come here, I would take care of the forest. So we have 60 acres of land, 12 of that is water. Okay, so 48 acres. 43 is forest. So forests are a very long-term asset. A very long-term ecosystem. So I have been working on reducing non-native vegetation to basically, because I'm obsessed with pawpaws, North America's largest fruit, Acemina triloba, not the papaya that we call papaya and UK calls pawpaw papaya. Anyways, North America's largest fruit, which is related to Cherimoya, grows wild in our forest here. So we have all these non-native species that get completely out of control and push out this really incredible biodiversity that we have on the shrub layer of pawpaw, spice bush, red bud, flowering dogwood, musselwood, American plum, American hazelnut. Like, it's like our forests were just completely beat up from deforestation, plowing, burning, overgrazing, blah, blah, blah. And what came back was not very great, but there's amazing tree species here that it needs supported. So always I was doing work here. I was running festivals because I was into that whole scene of Boom Festival, helping with that. I never went, but helped set it up. And so I would have these festivals and different things here to take advantage of the pub space with our liquor license, and the space to be in the countryside, a beautiful space, places to camp. But yeah, this like longing to want to to rotate animals, which is why I was a couple minutes late to our call this morning, because I'm moving goats from this pasture to this pasture because the kidding season has finished and now the kids can be out in electric fence. Had 21 kids born this spring and I have one more mom to go. And yeah, I'm learning different agroforestry techniques. I'm learning about different tree crops. I'm learning what works in terms of planting strategies, watering strategies, how to mix and arrange. And this climate is really unique though, because you know, I didn't go anywhere in Europe, or anywhere in the world where I have the same climate. From what I understand, the Ukraine probably has the most similar climate to here, where you're getting 90 degrees Fahrenheit in the summer with high humidity. It's like being in the tropical jungle. To, you know, last winter we had negative 30 wind chill, which equates in Celsius and in Fahrenheit. And the farm is still, there's still repercussions from that minus 30 with my flock of sheep. So it's a climate of extremes. So as much as I was learning about patterns otherwhere, there's other places, there are these specific details of this climate that make it very unique. And I'm in the Ohio River Valley. Like literally I can throw a stone and hit the backwaters of the Ohio River, which is one of these great rivers of the world, you know, kind of like the Danube in central, in Eastern Europe. That's maybe the most similar sort of ecosystem that Europeans might be more familiar with. But really amazing biodiversity in the tree species of the forest. And just with the heat and humidity, things grow.
Yeah. So you're back on their land. So as well as being away, you're obviously learning business skills when you're abroad as well. Did you do any specific training for that, or was that just sort of hustle just and get it done?
It was both. So I was a digital nomad before there was that term, right? Because I had started this brand on WordPress, and that's what enabled me to make my way around the planet, right? Like all of a sudden I would literally open my email one day and someone would say, can you teach a course, blah, blah, blah. So, but in that early part of Europe, 2009, 10, 11, I also got a job at a university here in the States called Maharishi University of Management. Maharishi was the guru who brought transcendental meditation to the West, including the Beatles. That's kind of how most people know of that name. And he set up a university in the state of Iowa. And he had just passed in like 2007, I think it was. And the university was really going towards this sustainable living department. And they had 100 and something people in their PDC, and they needed more teachers. And through the connection of, I was actually at the carbon farming course, which was probably the most epic constellation of teachers maybe ever in 2009, that course of Darren Doherty, Kirk Gadzia, Elaine Ingham, Eric Tonesmeyer, Brad Lancaster, and Joel Salatin, like, was maybe the best lineup of teachers for a 4-week course you could possibly imagine. And so a friend of mine that I knew from the West Coast, she got me this job teaching permaculture at the university. And I only had a 2-year degree, and I'm teaching, and I'm 29 years old teaching permaculture at a university. And so the university says, hey, the students really like you. We can see you're a really good teacher, but we need you to get a 4-year degree. So I signed up for an online degree. So I'd be sitting in a flat in Paris or in the countryside in Portugal or wherever, studying for my degree. So I ended up getting a degree in small business management. So one of the things that I learned in that small business management class was exactly what you were talking about earlier with your blog, is what they taught us was put all of this information online for free because it will make you seem like you're such an authority that people want to contract your services. Now, there are so many things hidden behind paywalls and whatnot. So at that time, I started writing because I have so much in my head. And I wanted to deepen my own learning of the subjects so I could teach better. And what I was finding is I teach a course, and let's say there was follow-up questions about compost. I'm spending 30 minutes writing the same blog over and over again. So I wrote an article on compost. And the first article I ever wrote was how to use PowerPoint as a design tool. And I sold that to PRI. And then I was like, no, I'm doing this for myself. And I started a second website, triopermaculturedu.com. And there I have 150 articles on permaculture that I wrote for years. And then I kind of stopped. Because I'm a bit too hands-on. One day I'm gonna zoom back out and start writing again. But it's sort of I like to think of it as the modern version of the designer's manual. There's instead of 14 chapters, I use the same 14 chapter approach, but then there's four more chapters. And so that was a key to my success was people would say, you know what, I read your articles already. I'm coming to Portugal to take your course. I can see you know what you're talking about because of the pictures, because of the experience. I want you to be the one to develop my land in Spain or wherever it was. I just got an email for the first time forever like that the other day. Hey, can you develop my piece of land in Majorca for me? So it was a lot of brand building. And at one time, me and Richard Perkins were like filling up courses, you know, like in kind of jostling for like who's the leader in Europe. And he started to put everything behind a paywall, and he got very rich and famous from it. And I can't say I did the same, but yeah, it was a lot of brand building, just writing, posting in groups, and I had excellent reviews from students, so it was really easy to fill the next course because people would go back to X, Y, or Z, mainly Northern European countries, and say, look, you got to go to this place in Portugal or in Spain and take a course.
Yeah. And cause for so for someone starting out, what would your advice be to them? They build their own blog, get involved, and just put that knowledge out there.
Yep. As soon as you're done, just start putting together your own website. Just and start writing. Because at the end of the day, the internet will always, content will always be king. Like that phrase will, those people, modern marketers say, no, but content will always be king. So, especially in our field, I believe. And the whole purpose of it is not necessarily to attract customers. The primary purpose is for you to learn through writing, because it's like why we do the design project in the PDC. We don't have to do that. We don't have to spend a quarter of the 72 hours, but the apply now part of the learning pyramid is designed for greater retention. So you have to, oh yeah, what did he say about a swale? Oh yeah, it's on contour. Okay. So as you start implementing and you start documenting, then you get a lot of integrated knowledge about what you're doing, and it makes you reflect and become, for lack of better words, a more spiritual person, because you are sifting through the emotions and the experience of every single journey that you went through. So I think that's the main thing, is just write, you know, take pictures, do your designs on the computer or on paper and put them up. And it's not necessarily to see these wonderful stats and conversions and whatnot. That's not the primary purpose. The primary purpose is for you to learn, other people to learn. And then if that converts into sales, fantastic.
Yeah, and it takes time.
It takes time. Months.
For us, well, for me, I know the blog is also a good a reference when you're talking to clients. So particularly feedback calls, if you're saying, here's the methods of compost, and you just send them one article.
Yes.
And you can just send that, and you can have five or six articles listed. Here, you want to start, go read these. And it's you're sending them to your material rather than somebody else's. That's the big that's what I'm getting the most just off it at the minute, is when talking to clients, it's just having that resource there for them. We're not in the heady heights, big numbers or anything. Well, it's still good to have. So see, when you got your own place, what did you prioritize in terms of your business, in terms of, right, I need to get money, and I take it you needed cash flow first so you can then concentrate on the bigger projects, the long-term stuff?
Yeah, so I don't pay a mortgage. Okay, so like, I know some people are in that complexity of a mortgage. I pay rent to my family, but it's basically just covers the utilities and the insurance. So coming out of COVID in 2001, what happened was there's a third party organization similar to Food Forest Abundance in the States called ThriveLot. And ThriveLot helped me to line up nearly 100K in installation work. We started in the fall of 2020, and then it was like the designs, the budgets, all of that are happening. And in 2021, I started doing installs as if I was a landscaping company for the first time ever. You know, I've always done permaculture installs, but being local, being like more long-term with the clients as well, as I think part of what, or where you're just like churning through a client list, I guess, is what makes it more of like a landscaping company. But when you need resources like cardboard for sheet mulching, plants for planting, fencing for protecting plants from the incredible amount of wildlife that we have here, compost, you know, these basic things that you need to do and install, tools. I already had a work van. For any landscaper, I can highly recommend a work van rather than a pickup truck. It just makes transporting plants so much easier. So you can, if you have access to a piece of land, can you start to create your own compost? Can you start to grow some of your own plants? Can you get bigger shipments of materials so that you're buying in bulk? So I was able to buy in bulk for planting my nearly 2-acre garden, which I call it an orchard garden, which it's a mix of alley cropping and food forest. And I started a nursery, and I have enormous compost piles that then get put into the 250-gallon, 1,000-liter tanks, and then we do worm composting. So you have to decide, what am I going to be a producer of? Where am I going to source my materials from in the beginning? And what can bulk purchases both help with the client and developing your own long-term resources on a particular piece of land? So by having a installation company, right, you can buy, let's say, 100 trees instead of 10, and you get that 100 for such a good price. And you have a nursery and you have the installations, and then you have them planted on your own land that you can then take and use that material one day. If it's an elderberry bush for cuttings, if it's a enterprise apple for taking scion wood and grafting with one day. So, I don't know. It's a really difficult question to answer for me because there's so many moving parts within my business and within the farm, but they're all complementary. They're all like, I know I want to put compost down at insulation, right? Like that's a normal practice. Am I going to buy that from a landscaping company around here? No, because it's not compost. It's closer to biochar than it is compost, actually. It's black. It's been burnt. It was super anaerobic. It went up to 180 degrees Fahrenheit. It's good for adding organic matter, but I consider it more to be biochar than actual compost. If you're wanting to bring life into a system, you got to make your own compost. But the price of making your own compost it can get a little bit high, especially in the beginning. So yeah, maybe ask another question to help me focus.
I think it's a good example of it can be scaled down as well to the person. So if I'm starting now, I have my own garden tools. I have a trailer, so I can go out and do gardens. And then, but if you're right, Mick, start making a list of what's costing you. My compost is costing me this, the plants. Anybody can probably get strawberries easily. You can just build your own stock. And then when you run out of room in your own garden, you can rent land and then you can buy land. So it's definitely scalable.
Yes.
And then you scale according to how comfortable you are. And you might not buy your own compost. I remember getting compost that was still warm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
A big bag of it. And that's all right if you leave it sitting there and throw some worms on it and leave it for a year. But
yeah.
I didn't have that time. So I did put it down, but it was still warm. And it's like, oh, what can you do? But I make my own now, so I'm grand. But again, when it goes hot, I do leave it. Just let it mature for a while.
Yeah.
So you offer courses?
Yeah, so I work currently with a nonprofit called the Cincinnati Permaculture Institute, and we offer a winter weekend PDC, and we offer a year-long PDC where we meet once a month throughout the year, and I'm one of the lead teachers of that. And then my education center here at Treasure Lake, we offer a class, I would say 3-4 weekends of a month. So yesterday there was a shiitake mushroom, mushroom inoculation class that happened here. And some of my friends from Central Kentucky that I actually know from Portugal, one is Portuguese. They came and taught that course. So sometimes it's me teaching. Sometimes it's me partnering. Like my next course is a spring foraging course, and I'll be partnering with a friend of mine who's a great forager. And then the next course after that is my growing fruits and berries organically on the homestead, which is I want to get people more comfortable with this, but I also want to sell some plants from my nursery while they're here, and just broaden the horizon of more local foods. So sometimes, yeah, it's me, sometimes with a partner, sometimes I invite guest speakers to teach by themselves here at this education center.
Great. And what else do you on the property? Like, can you come and stay there during these courses?
Yeah, I have one tiny house. I used to have campgrounds, but now Amazon and DHL. I live 30 minutes from the city center. I live in a very unique part. There's a, like most cities, there's a highway that circles it, and every other exit off the highway is, you know, McDonald's and all this gas stations and blah, blah, blah. But this is the only exit in this area that is rural left. But I live right next to power plants. That's part of the reason why. But I live right next to the airport too. And so I can't have people camping here anymore because Amazon literally flies these enormous planes every 15 minutes all throughout the night. So it's mainly just like come for the day, bioregional sort of thing. But I do have a tiny house that some people will stay in, although I may have an apprentice start to stay in there now from this last PDC. So other farm enterprises, I have a nursery that focuses on disease-resistant plants. So I sell plants through my installs, and then I'm open to the public. We open tomorrow back to the public. And some of the plants are produced in my field nursery because I have sandy soil. I'm right next to the river. And the theory is that a meteor pushed all that sand up onto this particular shelf of land. I do consultations. I do designs. I do installs. I sell livestock. I sell maple syrup. And I sell eggs. And hopefully, you know, the orchard will produce this year. It's been a wild up and down of temperatures. So I'm not sure about fruit set yet, but I have a couple hundred, or I don't know how many fruit trees are out there. Somewhere in between 100 and 200 fruit trees are in that space. And in the alleys, we grow different things. So we have a row of fruit trees, then 25-foot space. And then another row of fruit trees and berry bushes. And in those 25-foot spaces, sometimes it's nursery stock is grown. Sometimes it's vegetables. Sometimes it's other cane fruit that is more for production. So hopefully we'll be selling more produce this year. We had a goat petting party 2 weekends ago, so I kind of have a petting zoo, I guess, starting.
So how are you managing all this? Do you use any particular software, or is it just lists?
No. It's a bit much right now, to be honest. I have a lot on my plate. I do have a couple of employees. I do lean into some third-party organizations like Thrive Lot and Food Forest Abundance to help generate leads. I do sort of trades with people for marketing stuff. Like I'll trade some nursery plants. You know, I'll give them some apple trees for some marketing stuff. I have one student that I do that with. I do have some volunteer days, very rarely, to help offset some of the labor cost. But no, it's I have a design. In PowerPoint, everything's very well documented. And it's just a lot of orchestration in my head, especially on the rotational grazing part. You know, within a week, I'm going to have 100 ruminants here, 50 goats, 50 sheep. And that's a lot. So that's its own complexity. And oh, by the way, there's this enormous garden over there. And oh, there's the nursery. And now we're doing annual nursery sales. And I've got a list of clients that need my attention because it's been wet and I was dealing with the nursery and the kidding and the lambing. And so, yeah, it becomes a lot sometimes, but I'm a disorganized person exteriorly. But maybe it's the Virgo brain in me. It's very well organized inside my head.
Organized chaos. Exactly.
Which is permaculture. That is exactly, it's the best description of permaculture is organized chaos.
Yeah. I think it's too, it's important to get demonstrates all the multiple sources of income, keeping things diverse. You're not relying on one thing. Doug, is there anything you'd like to say now before we wrap up?
I think that's it. Is just I'm a Mollison freak, so I'm a very practical person, and I find that too many people lean into Holmgren's principles these days. And I really encourage people to go back to the intro to permaculture book, not the designer's manual. The intro to permaculture book for me is still the most important work for people to go back and reflect on the practical part of permaculture. And then besides that, I would just say, I don't want it to be fear-based, but it's like get ready. Like let's just keep planting and promoting an alternative culture, because it's something we love. We love community. We love biodiversity. We love nutrient dense food. Whatever it may be, find that thing that grips you from a space of love, not just fear to motivate you, because fear is exhausting, but a place of love that you really can propel yourself forward and have a positive impact around you. Once you find that source of love, you're going to be unstoppable.
Great advice. Doug, thank you very much. And for the audience as well, we have our PDCD Pro course out as well at the minute. Learn digital design. And so you learn Affinity, how to do your drawings in Affinity. Learn how to build yourself a website, get yourself a portfolio online, which is very important once you do a PDC. And also how to use the plant database Gilda, which is developed by Mike Jones. Basically, if you want an apple tree guild in Kentucky, type in the apple that you want and then the grow zone, and it'll list you out a full guild. So guys, thanks very much, Doug. And thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you.
See you next week.